A new documentary will premiere at the Siskel Center on State Street. It's produced by American Experience and PBS, and it's called Command and Control. It takes a close look at the safety of nuclear weapons, including an incident in Arkansas back in 1980, where an accident almost detonated a nuclear warhead. The film asks the question, how do you manage weapons of mass destruction without being destroyed by them? The documentary is based on the book by award-winning author Eric Schlosser. Schlosser's book was called Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. He's also the producer and co-writer of the film. Schlosser, of course, is the famed investigative reporter and author behind the books Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal, which looked at sanitary conditions, among other things, in the fast food industry, and Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. Eric Schlosser's in town for a discussion after the screening tomorrow night, or before part of the screening at the Siskel Center, and he is my guest at the big table tonight. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's such a great film, and it's something that I didn't know much about at all. Let's talk about nuclear warheads and safety protocols. What first sort of grabbed your attention about this story when you wrote the book a couple years back?
I was spending time with the Air Force. I got really interested in the future of warfare in space. And most people don't realize, but we have a U.S. Space Command and an Air Force Space Command, and they're in charge, if we go to war, in controlling outer space. So I was spending time with these guys. I was visiting some of their top secret bases. And a lot of them had been missile launch officers during the Cold War in charge of ICBMs with nuclear weapons. So when we weren't talking about laser beam weapons or particle beam weapons and directed energy beam weapons that may or may not someday be deployed in space, they started telling me stories from the Cold War about nuclear weapons, about accidents, mistakes, things that went wrong. And one of the officers told me the story of an accident at an ICBM silo in Damascus, Arkansas, in September 1980. And this is what happened. Some guys were working on the missile in the silo, just routine maintenance. They were standing on a steel work platform near the top of the missile. One of the guys dropped a tool, and it bounced on the steel work platform. He reached for it, missed it, and it fell in this narrow gap between the work platform and the missile. It fell about 70 feet, hit the silo wall, ricocheted, and hit the missile. And when it hit the missile, it ruptured a fuel tank, and suddenly there were thousands of gallons of rocket fuel pouring into the silo. And the Air Force had no idea what to do. And it was important for them to figure out what to do because the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever built was on top of that Titan II missile in that silo that night.
I mean, it pales into the hydrogen bombs and the other bombs that we've created. This is the biggest nuclear warhead ever.
This warhead was 600 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. Jeez. And the statistic that's even more mind-blowing for me is this one warhead was 3 times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. So when this officer told me the story, I was like, how come I've never heard of this? This is unbelievable. And I set out to write a fairly short book that would be like a thriller telling minute by minute what happened to try to, you know, prevent this missile from exploding and to prevent the warhead from detonating. And I wound up writing a very long book about all the close calls and nuclear weapons accidents that we had that were kept from the public.
That's the part of the documentary that sort of sets up the story of Damascus, but it is the part that's really the root of your book. But, I mean, there are so many – everything from B-52 bombers to strange silo accidents and things of that nature that we've never heard of, that there have been serious accidents with serious bombs.
Yeah. You know, during the Cold War – the government felt it was really important to maintain popular support for our nuclear arsenal. And as a result, they did not want publicity of when things went wrong. And the reality is there were a number of occasions in which American nuclear weapons almost detonated on American soil in an accident. It could have taken out not just cities, but entire states. Now, I'd like to think this is all Hollywood stuff that I made up, but the book, you know, was based largely on interviews with people who were handling nuclear weapons, in charge of nuclear weapons during the Cold War. It's based on documents that I obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. And Last night we did a screening in Palo Alto with a lot of former defense officials and nuclear weapons people from Los Alamos and Livermore, and it's true. They had no qualms with the film and found no mistakes in it, and this is the reality.
It's amazing to think about, because, you know, there's a great stat in the documentary just about, you know, thought that during the Cold War, to be able to take out the Soviet Union, we needed, 50 to 70 bombs, something of that nature, and we ended up manufacturing 32,000.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show that, you know, we kind of went overboard when it came to nuclear weapons. And not only that, but it takes personnel, it takes human beings, it takes, just so many sort of protocols to keep these weapons, I guess the word would be safe in a way.
They're machines.
Yeah.
It's like you're maintaining a machine. And you know, in the book and in the film, I try to give credit to our weapons designers, to the technicians, especially to the servicemen who risked their lives and sometimes lost their lives trying to prevent these nuclear catastrophes. And it is a testament to their skill that none of them really detonated. But the reality is, you know, like I say in the film, these are machines. It's hard to think of a machine that's never gone wrong.
Eric Schloss is my guest tonight. He's the author of Command and Control Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety, which has been turned into a documentary called Command and Control, which is produced by American Experience and PBS. Eric's also co-writer and producer on the film. It's at the Siskel Center at State Street. Starting tomorrow, you're going to have a discussion at 8 o'clock, and it's going to run through the week. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back more with Eric Schlosser here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, great author and investigative journalist. It's amazing to have Eric Schlosser in studio with us here. Thanks for being here. The author of Fast Food Nation, Reefer Madness, and of course, Command and Control Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety, which has turned into a documentary, which is Command and Control, which will be at the Siskel Center starting tomorrow. And I want to talk to you about that process, and we'll get to that. But we'll stay on nuclear weapons for a minute here. You know, it's amazing to me that this has fallen out of favor in the American populace. I mean, we don't talk about nuclear weapons. We don't talk about safety. We don't talk. There were times when there were protests and you know, protests for nuclear freeze in the 80s. But once the Cold War sort of went away, we just act as if nuclear weapons have gone away. And the only time you ever hear about it is, you know, we'll hear in this campaign, do you want this candidate to have the nuclear codes? But we don't know much about the nuclear warhead arsenal that remains.
Yeah. Well, I was in college in the 80s, and we all knew about it then. And there really was a feeling on college campuses that we might die any day in a nuclear war. And we now know that was true. And the people who were in charge of the government during the Reagan administration and in the Soviet Union were really afraid there might be a nuclear war. And especially in the year 1983, we came pretty close. So, you know, those of us who are, you know, 19, 20 years old, we're wondering, well, are we paranoid? Is it right to be? No. I mean, there was real reason to be afraid. But, you know, thankfully, there isn't that level of risk, but the danger never really went away. If you're a freshman in college right now, and you're 18 years old, you were born 7 years after the Soviet Union vanished. So there's no reason for you to know about these weapons and this sort of threat. But the danger never went away. You know, there are still thousands of weapons ready to be used. Right now, as we sit here, there are hundreds of missiles that could be launched within a minute. And people need to be aware. I'm not trying to terrify people and live in fear, but to me, this is one of the great threats that we face. And one thing I need to mention is that the documentary is directed by a good friend of mine, Robbie Kenner.
Yeah.
And we worked together on a documentary, Food Inc., which was partly based on my book, Fast Food Nation. And whereas Food Inc. was sort of an issue documentary looking at all the things wrong with our food system, this documentary, Command and Control, was our attempt to make a thriller.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it plays. It's amazing to look at the way you guys put it together. I mean, it is like a sort of suspense thriller that you'd see in the movies on TBS.
It starts off with a guy dropping a tool, and then the question in the film is, what's going to happen? Now we know that the state of Arkansas did not vanish in a fireball, But how did they solve this problem? Who gets hurt? Who doesn't make it out alive? When I was writing the book, I'd read a lot of the Cold War Tom Clancy novels, which were known as techno thrillers. So I tried to write the book as a techno thriller in which nothing works. Because the reality with this technology isn't that it all works perfectly mm-hmm. like in a James Bond film. It's that these are machines made by human beings, and in all kinds of unexpected ways, they mess up.
You know, one of the things, is, as you kind of mentioned, this idea of them being armed to the minute. I mean, this was sort of a byproduct of the Cold War. If the Soviet Union was going to launch, we need to be able to launch right away. That threat has changed, but that still remains, this idea that these nuclear weapons can be launched within a minute. That has to add to some of the tension. It has to add to some of the, I guess, the concern about, you know, if there's malfunctions, if things go wrong with a nuclear weapon.
Well, when you have these weapons ready to go, it's sort of like having a gun cocked, loaded, ready to fire. And it makes mistakes all the more potentially catastrophic. I mean, if a missile is launched, there's no calling it back. And if a missile with a nuclear warhead is on it, there's no deactivating the warhead remotely. You know, the 60 Minutes did a thing I helped them out with a few years ago, and an Air Force officer said, hey, once they're gone, they're gone. There's no calling them back. So we really need to think about, why do we have a sort of nuclear posture and strategy that came out of the mentality of 1963
right.
still in the 21st century? Because this machinery is aging. These missiles are getting old. The communication systems that link the missiles to headquarters are getting old. And, you know, I was with former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry last night at Stanford. And, I mean, he has been involved in nuclear weapons really since the early 1960s. He is a very sober, stable guy. He is not prone to exaggeration. And he thinks we should get rid of all these land-based missiles because of the risk of an accidental nuclear war. Now, those three words shouldn't even be said right. together. Accidental nuclear war. That's just insane.
And it's amazing, too, because as more sort of, I guess, weapons of mass destruction are produced and more sort of volatile, you know, situations arise in the world, it seems like we have gone to lengths to make sure that there isn't an accidental, you know, gas attack. Or you know, we try to find safety. But with nuclear warheads and such, it still is this possibility where we haven't created safeguards to eliminate nuclear weapons or to, I guess, be able to cancel them out if launched or if there's an accident or malfunction. There's no real safety on these
things.
Well,
you think of companies like Apple at the cutting edge of technology, but, you know, every now and then iTunes goes down. You know, the airline Delta recently had their whole reservation system go down. Netflix went down recently. Well, we don't want the control systems of our nuclear weapons going down and going offline that way. A few years ago, 50 of our missiles suddenly went offline, which meant that the launch crews could no longer communicate with their missiles, and that lasted for an hour. There was concern at the Air Force that someone had hacked into our nuclear command and control system and
disabled. It's like right out of a sci-fi movie, yeah.
But this is genuinely a concern now.
For all of the talk of nuclear weapons and keeping them out of the hands of terrorism or other rogue states, even Iran, you know, we talk about this. You know, where are we when it comes to either eliminating or recognizing some of the things that you're talking about in this documentary and in your book? Where are we as a society, as an American society? Where has President Obama gone? Where are we closer to saying that, you know, we recognize these threats, we recognize that this could be a problem, let's fix it?
Well, I'll give some good news. So the good news is, at the height of the Cold War between the United States and Russia, at one point there was maybe 70,000 to 75,000 nuclear weapons.
Wow.
And that number has come down. Now there's only 14,000 between the United States and Russia. So that's a huge decline. But when you look at what these weapons can do, I mean, one weapon can destroy an entire city. There's estimates that if 100 weapons were used in a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, it would kill 1 billion people. So 14,000 is still a very large number. Since the accident depicted in my film, we've done a much better job at putting safety mechanisms inside the warhead. The warhead that was involved in the accident in Damascus in 1980, it was basically Eisenhower-era technology. It was an obsolete weapon by 1980. So the weapons are safer. One of the things that concerns me is the weapon systems that we have are getting old. Like the Minuteman missile I mentioned earlier, that was put into duty in 1970. It was supposed to be retired in the early 1980s, so it was supposed to be retired 30 years ago. I was in a Minuteman underground control center the other day in North Dakota, not one that's currently in use, but that had been deactivated. But what's amazing is the computers in our launch control centers today are the same as the one that I saw. It's an IBM Series 1 computer, which was introduced in 1976. It was the height of technological excellence in 1976. But that's the computer that's going to get the launch order from the President of the United States. And so there's all kinds of ways that the system can go wrong.
Well, it's a fascinating documentary. It's called, and I'm excited to I was great to see it, and you should go see it. It's called Command and Control. It's based on Eric Schlosser's book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety. Eric's also the producer and co-writer on the film, and he will be there for a discussion at Siskel Center tomorrow night. This will be right before or after the screening that is scheduled for that time. All right, we'll take a break. Let's get an update on tonight's news. When we come back, I'd love to talk to you about the process of taking a book to documentary form and the challenges of doing that, and also a little bit about your other works as well. Eric Schlosser, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest at the big table, Eric Schlosser, a great author, Fast Food Nation, so great. And Reefer Madness, and the new documentary based on your book, Command and Control, will be at the Siskel Center coming up here tomorrow night. You're going to have a discussion about the film, about what we've been talking about, nuclear warheads, nuclear weapons, and safety issues. And it's the film is going to run as a Chicago premiere. It's going to run through the week down at the Siskel Center on State Street. For you as an author, you've worked with the director before and sort of, you know, transitioning to documentaries off your work. Talk about the difference between producing and writing a documentary and writing a piece of nonfiction.
Yeah. Well, you know, the emphasis for me is the book comes first. So I didn't entertain any notions of there being a documentary or a film until I finished the book. And I have the advantage. I mean, a lot of the book is the story of this accident. I spent hours hanging out with the guys who were there that night, the Air Force personnel who risked their lives to try to prevent this nuclear accident and try to prevent a detonation. And a lot of the book is their story. It's very different when you're making a film. And when Robbie, the director, is interviewing them, he doesn't have hours to get the story told.
Right.
He's got to get them to say on film what needs to be said to push the narration forward. And it's a real art, you know? I mean, when I'm interviewing people, I'm just kind of hanging out with them. He's got to put them on a soundstage in front of a camera with lights. And a lot of these guys have never spoken in front of a camera before. But for me, one of my favorite parts of the film is the way it honors these real heroes. Incredible. I mean, if you think about going into a missile silo with the most powerful nuclear warhead ever built and trying to save the missile, that is real heroism. And I think the interviews he did really, you know, acknowledges their valor, and there's a real emotional core to the film.
Yeah, there's some depth there. It's not only that, it's emotional, there's depth, and there's, you know, a lot of what happens in the film centers around the reaction, the Air Force's reaction. They kind of were like, what warhead? There's no warhead. There's nothing to see here, kind of.
Nothing's wrong.
Even to the point of blaming it all on human error, and you know, even to the point of some of the people who you said came in to deal with the fire or the vapors and the fuel, you know, almost they just weren't given their due. They weren't at all being – so there was a lot of emotion. There was a lot of – you could see the sort of the reflection from some of the people in the film.
And the other thing about the film, you know, I had visited this while researching my book, but there's one Titan II missile silo left in the United States, and it's been preserved as a museum. And so they had a great, you know, library there of documents that I used for my book, and I, I spent time there to get a feeling for the site. But when Robbie was filming there, it's just the most amazing film set that you'd ever want. I mean, it's this underground control center with these long corridors. This missile was also the biggest missile that we ever built. It's about the height of a 10-story building. So when you're standing at the bottom of the missile and looking up, it's just incredible. And I think that, you know, the film captures that feeling of being underground, almost with a monster. I mean, one review, a good review, compared it to a horror film. And, you know, it's a horror film about this monster, and the monster is the warhead on this missile that could blow up at any minute.
And you mentioned it earlier. I mean, it feels like a thriller.
Yeah.
It also, you know, it almost parallels some of the fictional stories of sci-fi lore of somebody hijacking a warhead or, you know, the codes being, you know, we've seen these kind of stories, but we've always known them to be sort of rich in fiction. To be able to see this actually happening and the thrilling and knowing that it actually happened, you know, it's a nonfiction story of something that happened in 1980, makes it work.
It's true. And, you know, this weekend we're going to screen it in Arkansas for the community where this accident happened. And they knew that something had gone wrong, but the government denied there was any possibility of a nuclear detonation. So it's only now, and really, I mean, really since my book came out a few years ago, that this community is even aware that they were almost vaporized in 1980. I mean, the secrecy was so extreme that it became absurd. I mean, the night of the accident, Vice President Walter Mondale was in Arkansas. He was at Hot Springs for a Democratic state convention. And when he heard that there was a problem at the missile site, he wanted to know, is there a warhead on the missile? And the Air Force officer sent to brief him said, sir, I can neither confirm nor deny that there's a warhead on
the
missile.
The Vice President, right.
So Vice President, and I interviewed Mondale, and his response was, God damn it, I'm Vice President of the United States. And eventually they told him. But, you know, that level of secrecy is insane. And as another Air Force officer later said to me, he said, what did people think was on the, you know, marshmallows? And and if they had just admitted that there was a warhead, they could have greatly reduced a lot of the panic in that area.
A lot of your work, especially the books, centers around industries that rely on secrecy, that really sort of fend off transparency. I mean, that's Fast Food Nation in a nutshell, the concept that cutting corners and making sure that the customer doesn't know about it. What's your attraction to those stories? What is it about the stories, whether it be the fast food industry or nuclear weapons and safety, that you want to write about?
You know, I came to journalism fairly late. I started out as a playwright and as a novelist and a screenwriter. And when I started doing journalism, I just wanted to do a kind of old-fashioned journalism and the obligation to sort of, sounds really corny, but serve the public interest and take on very powerful institutions that are keeping things secret. And there are certain things that should be kept secret, but I also think the public has a right to know. So with our food system, you have a right to know what you're eating and what's in your food and where it comes from. And in the case of these nuclear weapons accidents, these were really important events. These are really important things, and we have a right to know them. So I feel like it's been my job to uncover things that have been deliberately hidden from us by powerful bureaucracies, and I think it's wrong. And the other thing that I've tried to do is in all my books, and I hate doing it, but I think it's important to do it, is I have really extensive bibliography and source notes and footnotes. And I don't care if the reader ever looks at them, but if anyone wants to challenge if something is true, they can go look it up themselves. But also just, you know, as a basic principle, when all these government agencies and these corporations are trying to hide information, I want my work to be transparent.
Well, they don't want you, and they also don't want you to find it.
Right.
So, I mean, you have to have sources. You have to be able to say, this is where I found this stuff, because they'll do everything they possibly can to deny it.
And, you know, one of the struggles was getting this information on nuclear weapons accidents. If you were to do a Freedom of Information Act search and say, I want documents about nuclear weapons accidents, they'd say, well, we can't find any. I was very fortunate early on in my research that somebody gave me a document. It wasn't a classified document, but it had a long list of classified documents in it. And then when I did my Freedom of Information Act search, I had the exact name of the document and the memo. And the government couldn't deny that it existed,
and
because
for anyone listening out there, for journalists, you know, the Freedom of Information Act is obviously the act for you can get documents that before the act happened, the whether it be the Chicago Police or whether it be the NASA or whoever it is, they didn't have to give you anything.
Yeah.
Now they do, but they found a way around it, and one of it is how you ask the question. And they can be very yes or no, and if you don't ask your question the right way, if you're too generic, they can say nope or yes and give you the wrong stuff. So it's almost, I mean, it was a very, very lucky thing that you had the specific numbers to get, because otherwise you probably never would have found that.
The government also really must have wondered, how does he know that these documents exist? Because some of them were very obscure. There were a memo from one nuclear weapon designer to another nuclear weapon designer in 1961 that was top secret, but I knew the letter, I knew the date had been written. The other thing that's kind of amazing is, as I was starting to get all these documents, so much of them were blacked out by the censors. But the censors are really incompetent, because they'd hire different people to censor documents on the same subject. So I'd get different documents on the same subject and compare the two. And one guy had blacked out one thing, the other guy had blacked out another thing, and you could compare the two and get the full story. So there are some things that should be kept secret. But overwhelmingly, what I found is the things that were being kept secret were things that were going to embarrass government bureaucrats or embarrass the Pentagon, and they just didn't want us to know.
And so many times it's about the bottom line, of course, but it's also about image. It's about, like you mentioned at the top, I mean, that this was a popularity contest. They needed to say that nuclear weapons were popular, and they couldn't have accidents after accidents after accidents that people would say, I don't want this as part of, I don't want to get behind this.
And I mean, this is going to sound really corny, but I believe it. Knowledge is power. And if the government or if corporations are trying to keep information away from you, they're trying to maintain the power and keep the public in the dark and therefore more easily controlled. So again, some things must be kept secret, but if we're going to have a democracy and as consumers, I mean, this was really true for Fast Food Nation, you know, you don't have any freedom as a consumer if you don't know where your food came from. You can't look at it and tell the difference between meat that's contaminated or meat that's clean. So, you know, that's why I do what I do.
Well, Eric Schlosser is my guest as we wrap up here. I mean, there's something about it. You think about Fast Food Nation, and it's a conversation starter in the way that before Fast Food Nation, it wasn't something that we were paying attention to, how the food was made in places like McDonald's or Burger King or other places that, you know, I don't single out one, two companies, but the idea that, you know, we didn't think about it at all. I mean, do you think about that with your books, the idea of these almost being conversation starters, whether it be migrant workers and or, you know, sort of labor injustices or, like you said, with the sanitation, the food industry, or in this case, nuclear weapons? I mean, these are conversation starters.
Well, you know, you're right on the mark. I mean, if you read any one of my books, I'm really not trying to tell anybody what to think. It's not like a polemic, a dogmatic argument. It's basically what I've found in my research. I'm trying to get people to think. I'm trying to provide information to them that they may not get from the mainstream media, they may not get from other sources, and I'm trying to do it in a way that's a pleasure to read, you know. And for me, it's really interesting because I learn about all these subjects. I mean, I never would have known about nuclear weapons before, and I feel, you know, it's what I do is to try to expose these things that are being kept hidden.
Can you tell us what you're working on?
I have been working for many, many years on a book on the American prison system.
Oh, man.
And I hope to finish it this year. And again, these prisons are out of sight. They're out of mind. And what's happening in these prisons is really important for every one of us.
I mean, I can't thank you enough. Eric Schlosser, the award-winning author of books like Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal, also Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market, and Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and The Illusion of Safety, which has been turned into a documentary produced by American Experience and PBS. It's going to be at the Siskel Center starting tomorrow night, the Chicago premiere. It's going to run a week, but tomorrow night you will be there at 8 o'clock having a discussion about the book. So if you want to come out and meet Eric and also listen to the discussion, it's at the Siskel Center here on State Street in downtown Chicago. Eric Schlosser, thanks so much for being my guest at the Big
Table. Thanks for having me, man.